Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Jennifer Egan is one of my favorite writers. If you've read her, she's probably one of your favorite writers as well. It's not always super easy to interview someone whom you admire so much, but Jennifer Egan definitely made it easy for me to interview her for this most exciting new episode of Wheels Off. I'm so stoked for y'all to hear this super useful conversation we have. Like, a lot of really great, actionable, like nitty-gritty stuff about making art in general, about writing specifically. Does Jennifer Egan know what she's talking about? Yes. If you've read her work, you agree with me. There's no doubt. She's one of the great writers of our time. And she has the accolades to prove it. Obviously, the Pulitzer Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, National Book Critics Circle Award. She's got all of that, but she's very much, as my old 97s bandmates and I like to say, she's one of us. She's just a person who likes to work. She's down to earth, real, sweet, funny, kind, generous. I know that's a word I use a lot in relationship to the guests of my Wheels Off podcast, but that word definitely describes most of the folks I get to speak to. Definitely describes Jennifer Egan. Very generous, very funny, kind. She's great. This Wheels Off is great. I feel like I could drop the mic and walk away and be happy with the work I've done. But I will continue on, soldiering on to bring you guys the secrets behind the messy reality that is the creative life. Please welcome to Wheels Off, Jennifer Egan. Welcome to Wheels Off, Jennifer Egan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
For the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
Brooklyn, New York.
Nice. Has that been your home for a long time?
It has. I've been here now going on 23 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's the translation of that is I'm old. You can live anywhere for that long.
Yeah, we moved into our house 19 years ago this month, and our son will be 19 in a couple of months. So
my oldest is almost 22. So I guess we kind of have the same settling down prerogative history.
I love it. I love it. Congratulations on the candy house. It's so great.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, boy. And I was so glad to get to check in with some of these characters and storylines and the world from Goon Squad. It was such a great, you know, being a musician and having spent a lot of time in the music industry, especially as it collapsed, it was such a fascinating thing. And you dealt with it so well, because I think that you let it just be a setting rather than like every single line it has to be about music.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not very musical, in fact. So, you know, I don't play an instrument. I can't read music. It's strange in a way how much music inspires me and how much how many ideas I get from it, given how really, what a complete lack of talent and aptitude I personally have in the realm of music. So there's kind of a disconnect there that sometimes my readers are surprised by, because they think, well, you must at least know a lot about this. I really don't. But it's very meaningful, both as a source of form ideas, but also watching what happened to the music industry, or really in a way more learning about it later, because since I'm not in the industry, I sort of dimly knew from the news, like, oh, the music industry is collapsing. But I only really got to understand that better when I was talking to people while writing, or before writing Goon Squad. But that, my awareness of that story and all of the elements of it, you know, how Napster works, what it involves, what kind of bargain it makes with it made with the consumer who felt like they were getting stuff for free, but in fact were paying in ways they didn't understand. All of that has ended up being so meaningful and almost a template for so much else that has happened online. So the music industry and music itself has ended up being extremely rich for me, even though I'm not a musician and have no talent.
It's funny that you say that, though, because in reading your stuff, I find a lot of musicality just in the words, in the way that you string together sentences, and the way that you'll have like little quick hitting passages that happen that are almost like a refrain of a song.
Well, that's interesting, because maybe what both of us are feeling is that there's ultimately no difference between music and writing. Storytelling began as an oral tradition, and I like to remember that and think about that all the time. And in fact, in the writing group that I have, we only read aloud. So there's actually no text. Whoever wrote the thing, whatever it may be, reads it however long it takes. Sometimes it can be way too long, but we have that auditory experience of the work. And what I love about it as a creator is that it forces me early on to attend to the sound and the rhythm of the language itself, which is an essential element of prose. Even if we're just reading it on the page, those forces are acting on the reader, whether they know it or not. And if the writer isn't harnessing those tools and using them, it's just a lost opportunity.
And so many people consume their books nowadays, like I do, via audiobook.
Oh my God. I'm an absolute audiobook addict. I am working my way through all those endless 19th century books that I didn't read before. I can't figure out why this hasn't caught on more widely, but I just feel like, look, we love serialization. Everyone's addicted to TV serials. I'm not that into TV. It's all happening in 19th century fiction. They were the first serializers. And so all the things we love from serialized storytelling are in those books. And listening to them on audio gets around the fact that they're extremely long and cumbersome, and sometimes the print is really small. It's just such a joy. I feel like it's added a whole dimension to my life, audio fiction.
Boy, and the great readers mean a lot. It goes a long way, especially in some of those like really famous old classic books. They'll have like a famous actor reading it as sort of a vanity project, which is sweet, because they're fantastic.
Well, and actually, the reader is incredibly important. One reason I love to read stuff that's in the public domain rather than new fiction is the new fiction just has one reader, but work that's in the public domain often has a choice of many, many. And so you can find the one that really feels right, which is pretty essential, especially for a book that's going to be, you know, in the case of one book, classic I read recently, Clarissa. So 18th century, one of the first novels told completely in letters, 100+ hours.
Wow.
And it is off the charts amazing. So great. I cannot recommend it too highly.
That's so great. What's the word for that? Epistolary?
Yes. That,
and it's funny. There's a section in Candy House that's kind of that, the emails, right? That,
yeah.
I love that. And it's funny because you deal so much in, I've kind of thrown away my normal format for this and I'll get to it momentarily, but I'm fascinated by this. You deal so much with technology, right? And the sort of terrifying aspects of the sharing and oversharing and I recently reread a bunch of Vonnegut, which I hadn't read since high school. I was going to do an interview with his library and really fell in love with it and found things that I had forgotten completely about. But his Player Piano, for instance, his first novel, had so much that I, because having recently read that and reading yours now, there's common threads. It's the idea of an artist, a novelist grappling with how much our lives are being subsumed by technology. The technology we depend upon to make our lives easier is making them disappear almost in a way. And I wonder, first of all, did you grow up reading Vonnegut? Were you a fan of his at all?
You know, he was not a much of an influence for me. I've read a couple of his novels, not for many, many years, though. So yeah. I would have to say no, interestingly. Yeah. One reason maybe that he was my first stepfather's favorite writer, and he was always like demanding that I read.
It's the worst.
I know. It may be why your kids aren't playing your guitars.
Exactly.
So no, I would have to say Vonnegut is not an influence. Well, okay, not a conscious influence, because there's a big difference there. You know, there are people I want to be influenced by, and who knows if I am or not. And then there are all the things that we don't know are acting through us.
So I know right now, probably so much of your life is taken up by promoting the new book. I wonder about, are you able to work during this time? Like, and what creative project are you working on right now? And how does it light you up?
I am working because there's such a long lag between finishing a book and having it come out that I've learned over time, it's really a good thing if I can use some of that time to get a foothold on new stuff. The way that I work is so improvisational at the beginning that it always feels a little bit presumptuous to say that anything is really going to happen. But the two things that I'm working on now are, I'll just mention sort of the time and places that they involve, because that's always my entry point into fiction. Oddly, it's time and place, not people or plot. But I'm really interested in 19 sort of immediate post-war Bay Area. So San Francisco-ish in the 1950s. I'm very interested in a genre approach to that. So we'll see what happens. I love detective stories. So yes. Hard to add value to that genre because there are so many people who have done it so well. So we'll see. Big question mark there. And then the other is very different, but 19th century New York, specifically sort of immediate post-Civil War New York, but pre-Gilded Age. So I'm sort of interested in New York before the inventions that I think we think of as more 20th century, but really were 19th century, like electric lights, recorded music, film, et cetera. So I'm interested in the time before that, just before that. And I don't know how I'm going to approach that. I've written a historical novel that I thought would involve a lot of trickiness in approaching period, but in fact, it repelled all of that and demanded to be told kind of straightforwardly. But this time I'm feeling more like just placing us in the 19th century feels actually really artificial. And so I'm not sure, I think somehow addressing that artificiality head on may be the way to kind of neutralize it rather than, you know, with Manhattan Beach, I just kind of got in there and told the story. I have to always feel my way through because I just don't know what the particular story is going to demand.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Remember when I said that you deal with music so well because you're not just like fixating constantly on the music, you let it be a piece of the story. I feel like that was with Manhattan Beach. It wasn't as if you were making a giant deal about the period nature of the story, right? It just happened to be in that time.
Well, I started out making a bigger deal about it. but I found that everyone hated that stuff. So I had to rethink it. I actually mean that literally. I started out thinking I will wink at the reader about the convention of just placing everyone into the past and expecting them to feel like they're there. But what was interesting was that those winks, instead of being helpful, were actually distracting and ultimately, according to my readers, enraging. So it's really not what the effect I was looking for. I mean, I like a strong emotional response, but not hatred for the material. That's not the response I'm looking for. So what I realized was that my winkiness was just an irritant. And so it had to go. And what I realized looking back on that later is that the material itself, which is so hyper-dramatic, I mean, war, you know, shipwreck, gangland murder, survival at sea. How does winking really fit into that context? I mean, the answer is it can only detract. I mean, maybe someone can pull it off. I shouldn't say that. I would love to read a winking approach to that stuff, but I think it's hard to wink and ask the reader to take something totally seriously. And from my point of view, you know, when you're dealing about with something like survival, mm-hmm. actual survival, not the feeling of, oh, I can't make it, but like someone's about to die. It's hard. Where does winking fit in? It sort of doesn't. So a straight up storytelling approach seemed to serve me best in that context.
Boy, and
but I got there the long way.
I wonder for you how that instinct to kind of wink at the conventions of genre fiction, detective fiction, might wind up playing out for you as you're working on it.
I wonder too, genre is so interesting because it invites winking. And in fact, that's one reason I thought I would wink in Manhattan Beach, because I came to that also with a genre vibe, which was kind of the noir, mm-hmm. Which is very, it can be very self-conscious, certainly in the realm of film. But in the end, it's interesting. I ended up in a different genre, which I wasn't expecting, which was sea literature, which is a genre unto itself, much less ironic. but the funny thing is, the two genres, who seem to have literally nothing in common at first glance, what I learned is that they are actually very similar, because each of them involves a small pocket of humanity surrounded by a kind of existential threat. And in the noir, it's usually the city. It's a very urban genre. There's a feeling of like darkness, bad stuff, bad people, you know, railroad overpasses and subway tunnels. And then in the sea genre, obviously it's the natural world. It's the enormity and the power of the ocean. And so in both cases, there's an immediate sense of drama because the stakes are high because of this existential threat. But somehow the winking, there was no place for it in that book. So we'll see. With the detective genre, it's, I don't know how, I think you have to wink with that one. If only to get a pass on not being that good at it, which is what I fear is my situation.
But I love that you're willing to go there, because, you know, that it seems like such a gulf between literature and genre fiction. And I know there's a lot of people that love both. I mean, I got to speak to Michael Chabon for this, and, you know, he is a big lover and supporter of genre fiction. He started off doing he was doing a lot of Sherlock Holmes fan fiction when he was a kid, basically. That was all his first stuff. And I love it. I think you'll be fantastic at it. I can't wait to read it.
I'm a huge genre fan. I don't think there's any difference. I wrote a gothic thriller and read nothing but gothic for a couple of years. So and there's a lot of winking in the gothic everywhere. So that was definitely an appropriate approach there. I also love genre fiction. And there's so much, as someone who's really driven by time and place, and another word for that is atmosphere. What I love about genre is that it's a kind of ready-made atmosphere that is inherently literary, when I say literary, I include all art forms, film, etc. I mean, one of the great gothic influences for me was the extremely cheesy soap opera called Dark Shadows, which I was forbidden to watch as a young child, and of course turned on every single time I came home from school and my mother wasn't there. So anyway, genre is really, really rich. And the question is always just how to do more than just follow the rules, how to contribute meaningfully. And we'll see if I can pull that off. I may not be able to. In my new book, Manhattan Beach, I thought of it very much, very consciously, as bringing in many different genres and thinking of each one as a kind of portal into a different world. And I was thinking about genre as basically fantasy portal. But in saying that, I don't mean in specifically a fantasy genre. I just mean the idea of moving among worlds as a way of experiencing art.
I love it. When you were, I wonder about origin story stuff for you as a writer. And was there a moment when you knew this was going to be your life? Was it something you always knew from before you were even conscious of your own self? Was there an epiphany moment?
I definitely wasn't someone who grew up thinking I wanted to be a writer. I was very sciencey. I wanted to be a doctor, actually. And I still think that could have been a great career. I have to say, I have a little bit of doctor envy the two times that my kids have ended up in the hospital, and thank God it's only been two times, I'm a little bit in awe of the doctors. they're amazing. Anyway, I was kind of a sciencey, you know, chemistry set owning type of kid, very tomboyish. My grandfather was an orthopedic surgeon who talked at the dinner table about cutting people open. I love that stuff. I couldn't get enough of it. Loved his medical books, especially the pictures of, like, I just loved I loved the sort of physicality of human beings. I wanted to dig up dead bodies out of the graveyard. To my grandmother's horror, I proposed it. So that's kind of where I started. Although I will say I always really loved imaginary games and sort of, like, you know, just playing a game in which we were characters, like, doing things. That was always really fun to me. And I loved reading and all that. But I guess the time that I feel like I really knew I wanted to be a writer was during a gap year that I took between high school and college. And I got a Eurail pass. I was traveling in Europe with a backpack, like, you know, like kids do. I felt really lost, you know. I was really lost. I was kind of an unhappy teen. My mother's second marriage was breaking up. I just felt, I was also, you know, I was really alone in a way that is almost impossible to conceive of now, because it was 1981 and there was no internet, there were no cell phones, and I was from San Francisco. And so I was 9 hours ahead in time at a period in our history when you made a phone call, it either rang and rang and rang, or someone picked up, that was the best outcome, or you got a busy signal. Like, that's how it worked. When I first told my kids that, they asked me if electricity had been invented. I mean, in all seriousness, that was so inconceivable to them. It was like, okay, you're talking about the realm of before electric lights, right? anyway, so in that kind of void that I was in, I had amazing times. I have to say, I still think about people I met then whose names I don't even remember. But I also had some pretty scary times, which were, I recognized later, panic attacks. But in the moment, I thought they were drug flashbacks, which tells you something about my high school years, which were just behind me. I mean, look, it was the late 70s in San Francisco. And we all thought Go Ask Alice was true. So we were all haunted by that possibility. So anyway, I was really freaking out. And ultimately had to come back early, which was very disappointing because I had worked so hard to earn the money for this trip. And I ended up having to buy a ticket back ahead of time and used up a lot of my money that way. But it had to be done. Anyway, in that void, because of the extremity of it, both positive and negative, what became very clear to me was that writing was just essential to my relationship to the world around me. Whatever kind of time I was having, it had to include a processing through writing. And so, you know, I have to say, I'm pretty grateful for that hellish trip, because it taught me something really important at a very early point. And I never wavered from that point on in my commitment to writing. I was never confident about what I had to offer. And in a way, that was really good, because even when I was not a precocious writer or a precocious person, so I didn't have much to offer early on, but that didn't dissuade me, because that was never why I had committed to it in the first place.
I wonder about that, because I'll see artists who are so confident, and I'll be jealous of that kind of confidence, because I've never had that really either. But I wonder if that feeling of hunger, maybe to prove oneself, or even just to actually get better at your craft, I wonder if that's an important thing that maybe is more valuable than being confident, hyper-confident.
You know, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, I think we only have our own inner lives that we really know ultimately. I mean, for myself, I can say that I'm very grateful. I wish I were more. I mean, I don't always feel stable, honestly. Like, I just feel very wobbly in my sense of myself. And I don't like that, because it's just not a comfortable way to move through the world. But in terms of my work, I think I would rather be that way than overconfident, because the goal is always to keep getting better. That's what has to happen. To stay in it, you have to keep getting better. And so anything that makes that harder to do is bad. And I think for me, that kind of hunger, that sense of, I don't know, or sometimes it's not even, hunger is too exciting a word. It's more like doggedness, just an unwillingness to stop. That quality has really helped me. It's such a pedestrian quality. It's such an uninteresting quality. It's just like, I feel like I'm a sort of like mule that keeps plodding along. I mean, no matter what gets thrown at me, I just keep going. And I have had huge success with the last couple of books, but I was well into my 40s before any of that came along. And all those years before that, I just kept going. And I don't want to sound like I was deprived, because I've been able to publish. My books have stayed in print. It's not like I've had a, you know, I've been ignored, but my success was very incremental. And I'm grateful for that, because I do think success in and of itself, attention in and of itself, can be distracting and can be problematic, because it can lead to a kind of self-consciousness and an anxiety and even a kind of paralysis, all of which can get in the way of the only thing that ultimately matters, which is continuing to get better. So yeah, I try to really focus on that. It's so important.
I love that. I mean, how many essential truths are boring like that? The doggedness is the trick.
Well, again, I would never want to say what is true for other people, because I do think the challenge is always, I think, for each of us to know what is going to wring the best work out of us. That's it. You know, what is the process that leads me to do my best work? And what are the conditions in which I can do my best work? For me, you know, the condition of being observed, the condition of being sort of watched is not one in which I'm going to get my best work done. So for example, although I use social media in a very workaday way, I'm not someone who has like a persona. I don't share details about my own life, because all of that feels uncomfortable and is not going to lead to conditions in which I'll do my best work. So I'm always thinking about that. Like, I want to lean into the things that I like to do and that are comfortable. Having conversations like this is a joy. So great, let's do it. But that's just a conversation like I would have with a friend. That's different from being observed or sort of offering up my experience in a curated way as a kind of sales tool, which is really, as far as I can tell, what social media almost always is, even if what you're selling is just your own life. That feels not comfortable and not something that's going to lead to my doing my best work. So it's personal, because I see other people who are using social media extremely effectively in the way I just described, and doing really good work. So more power to them. But it's and some of this, of course, is generational. Sure. You know, I'm technically a baby boomer, which is sort of horrifying. I'm like the last year of baby booming. That's some of it too.
But it's expected now, right? The constant access. And it's funny, so much of Candy House is kind of about this, right? And the letting people into your lives. I know a lot of musicians that are constantly putting their little kids on their feeds. I've never put my own kids on it. Just, it seems like a lot. It seems like a lot.
You know, it's interesting. Like, I feel like what underlies it is just the basic human wishes to share, to connect, to see, to know others and be known. And those are such basic human desires. It's just that when technology becomes the intermediary, they become different things sometimes. But that's been true from the very beginning. I mean, think about the telephone, like, gigantic difference between talking to people on the phone and actually being in the room together. In each case, there are gains and losses. So I don't feel judgmental, in that I'm mostly just very curious about all of it. And as you say, I use it in the Candy House, not in a dystopian way, but in a curious way, because that wish to see and be seen, well, the wish to see, the curiosity about other people's lives is what drives reading of fiction also, and what drives certainly the writing of it. So in the Candy House, I move in and out of 14 different, points of view and deep inside 14 different consciousnesses, and try to get at the different textures and ways that these people process their experience. And in a way, that my love of doing that and hopefully the satisfaction, you know, certain readers might take in it is not unlike the curiosity and the satisfaction of that curiosity that we find online.
It's funny. I know I, for one, when I reached the end of the Candy House, was only angry that it was over. I thought, you just gave me these people. What are you doing? Have you heard that?
Well, that's nice to hear. I mean, you know, it's an inherently open-ended world. Sometimes people express that in a more negative way, which is like, yeah, but you didn't resolve all these things. But it's the nature of a book like this that I really can't, because, you know, every person is the center of their own constellation of thought and experience. So if I'm really doing it's a very ensemble book. And the effect is kind of kaleidoscopic. It is one big story. It is one big design, but it falls into place momentarily because all the pieces align in a certain way. But I can't provide all the answers and gain all of that breadth. So in a way, you know, it's not unlike the kind of serialized form of storytelling where we have a lot of different characters. They move in and out of focus as the main character. Sometimes they're just someone we glimpse out of the corner of our eye. Other times we're right in the middle of their consciousness. To me, those shifts of perspective are really, really fun. And in a way, this is a book that's kind of about that shifting. So there's, and who knows, I may not be done with this world. We'll see.
So I love what you said about, first of all, about wobbliness. I think that's kind of a great word. I know I feel that. I imagine a lot of people feel that. For you, when you've run into those sort of the self-generated obstacles, the stuff inside of you that keeps you from maybe doing your best work or from just making it through a day without the anxiety attack or whatever that you mentioned before, I wonder, when you come up against that kind of stuff, what tricks have you figured out to make it through those tough moments?
Well, let's see. I mean, I would say there are some times when, for whatever reason, I just really feel down and it's just not possible to do certain things. I'll almost think like, this is a little like being ill today, you know? And so when you're ill, you don't try to do certain things, but there are other things that don't take much skill that you can tackle on that day. So I'll try to just do the things that can be done on a day when I feel really compromised for whatever reason. But generally what I find is that, you know, my problem is a kind of harsh inner voice that is discouraging rather than encouraging. And I've often thought, like, if I worked, well, I actually did work for a person who used to talk to me the way I talked to myself. And I stayed with her for 3 years. That tells you all you need to know. But any normal person in a work situation in which someone spoke to them the way I speak to myself would basically say, screw you, and walk out the door. Well, I can't do that with my own brain, unfortunately. So what I find is that actually it comes back to the doggedness. I often feel like I can't write in this state. And it turns out I actually can. So I don't take no for an answer very easily. And one way that I get myself to work, no matter how I'm feeling, is by requiring only quantity from myself, not quality. So my routine is to fill a certain number. And when I'm writing a first draft, I should say, because it's really different once I'm in the editing phase. When I'm writing a first draft, all I require is a certain number of pages a day. And I handwrite my first drafts. So, and there, that's also very helpful because my handwriting is very hard to read. And therefore, it's hard to judge because if I'm looking at a screen, the first thing I think is, oh, I got to go back and fix that. And that's kind of the advantage of writing on a screen. Like, you're sort of editing as you write, but that doesn't really work for me for fiction. I'm just trying to fill the pages there's less judgment that way. And it's harder to get out of it because I'm not saying I have to fill the pages with good stuff. In fact, I never know at the time if it's good or not, but I do have to fill those damn pages. And so it's a way of just keeping the process working, even when I feel like the harsh voice is, you know, really being cruel and this project has no merit, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Just get, fill the pages. You can think anything you want, but fill those pages. And it's a way that just the work kind of keeps happening no matter what my brain is telling me.
I love that. There's an analog in music. Leonard Cohen used to talk about if he had a song that had 7 verses in the finished version, he would have sat down and written 45 verses and then culled the best 7 or even the pieces of the best 7. So I wonder, your first drafts must have giant chunks that don't make the cut.
Absolutely. I mean, I love Leonard Cohen. I love hearing that because that's exactly right. Not only is it not bad to write badly, but I'm creating more choices for myself so that I can pick the best. And so with my first drafts of a long book, The Candy House was written in pieces, as was Goon Squad. But with a book like Manhattan Beach, I wrote it straight through. So I wrote for a year and a half without stopping. I forgot characters' names. I forgot their personalities. It made almost no sense. But even having characters' names and personalities change wasn't bad because in a way, those were just different verses and I could choose the best to move forward with. So yes, and with The Candy House, for example, I would say there was probably a 50% failure rate. But the word failure should be in quotes. Is it a failure if something doesn't make it into the next iteration? Or is it just a choice that I didn't end up rolling with? There was a lot of material I couldn't use. Let's put it that way.
It's funny. I get a lot of young songwriters ask me about songwriting. And I always tell them the first 100 songs you write will be lousy, but you have to write them. So then their usefulness is in their existence.
And I'm just a huge believer in trial and error, not as a learning process, as an actual creative process. You know, problem solving is great. I mean, whether it's on the level of the sentence, the paragraph, the chapter, it's an uncomfortable feeling to find out that something isn't working, either because I know it myself or because I find it out getting feedback. There's always that moment where I think, and this is back to the harsh voice, I can't do it, it sucks, blah, blah, blah. But the minute I know that something isn't working, I'm thinking about how to fix it. And so trial and error is a fantastic tool, even though the error part is always uncomfortable. And discomfort often feels really unhealthy and maybe even like a really bad sign. But I've learned over time that to not freak out because I'm uncomfortable, it doesn't matter. Be uncomfortable and then fix it. So I really do have a lot of, you know, correction in my creative process, and I look for it. You know, I have layers of readers. I want to know if there's a way to make something better before it's published, why would I not avail myself of that? In the end, I'm going to hear it all. I'm going to hear things no one thought of. So I might as well hear as much as I can ahead of time. It's not that I'm trying to please everyone. Don't get me wrong, because my books never please everyone. And I know that. But and in fact, they don't even please the same. One book doesn't please the readers of another book of mine. Mm-hmm. But I want to at least hear everything I can hear from as many points of view so that I have a chance to address whatever I think is valid. That's how I work. And there's a lot of discomfort in it, but in the end, it's the way of wringing out of myself the best possible work.
I love it. So I feel like, I don't know how much teaching you've done in your life, but just from listening to you today, I feel like you could be an amazing teacher. I really feel like you've shared so much with us today. Have you taught? Sorry.
Not much. Okay. Interestingly, I don't teach writing. I feel like there are people who do that really well, and I'm not sure I have more to offer than they do. I have taught literature I taught a literature course at the University of Pennsylvania, my alma mater. And I really did enjoy that, although I wasn't great at it. It was my first time. There were things that I could have done better for sure. But I loved reading with my students, especially works. For example, I started with Trollope. And I'm not sure any of them had read Trollope before. Great 19th century serialist. I had them do it on audio.
Nice.
It was very fun. They did not all love it, but it was really worthy. And we ended with Joan Didion. So we basically covered 100 years. And there was just a lot to be done there to think about. So of course we looked at books from the point of view of, you know, of literary criticism. What does the text mean? What is it telling us? But we also looked at them as cultural artifacts. And I had them do a lot of writing exercises and to sort of get their own creativity and access their own unconsciousnesses in class. So it was a real mix of things. And I'd like to keep doing that. I'd like to further develop all of that, because that felt more like something that was specific to me and where I could add value maybe. And I would like to get better at it. I feel like doing something once and not, you know, and doing it so-so, that's not a point to stop. That's something to build on, hopefully.
So now that you've got kids around this age of your own, I wonder if you would be willing to try and distill some of this wisdom you've shared with us into what you might tell a 21-year-old version of yourself working in today's world. If you were to encounter yourself, what advice might you give yourself?
Do I have to have one piece of advice? Or
no, as many as you want.
All right. So someone who wants to write specifically. You mean?
If this is up to you. After my parameters, it's all wide open.
All right. I think number one, I would say try to some degree start orienting away from the visual, which absolutely permeates our popular culture, and get to the text. So read more and read the kind of stuff you want to write. You know, if I'll sometimes find when I'm talking to young writers that everyone's talking about television. Great. Then write for television. If you want to write literary fiction, you need to be reading it. Just as all I'm reading right now are detective stories. I wouldn't dare to try to do this if I were not steeped in the genre. So that's number one. Number two is write regularly. Don't worry about writing well, just worry about writing regularly. Make it a habit. We are trainable creatures. We are like dogs. We will jump if we're taught to jump. So teach yourself to jump. Get to the point where not writing feels strange, just as if you exercise regularly, not exercising feels strange. That's what you want to do. Make it a habit. And number three is, even though as a culture, we lust for success and we all want it and we want it early, try to the degree that it's possible. And I couldn't even manage this without the internet. So how can I ask it of someone with the internet? I don't know, but I'm going to do it anyway. Believe me when I tell you that early success is not necessarily a good thing, and certainly not to be chased after as a goal unto itself. If anything, premature success, you'll be lucky to overcome it enough to keep doing good work. So do good work. That's all that matters. It's so hard to do good work. And it only happens if you make writing a habit, read well, and wring the best work you can out of yourself. Success is just an external thing. So just keep trying to get better. And if you do, this is a promise, you will have success. because there aren't that many people who do it well. That's my advice.
I love that. This is so great. I feel like the stuff you shared with me and the listeners today is so globally useful and so specifically useful to writers. This is going to be maybe my best Wheels Off ever. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure. It was great to talk to you. Really great.
You too. Well, good luck with all of the press I'm sure having to do for this new amazing book. And most exciting to me, good luck with the detective novel. Really excited for that.
We'll see what happens. This conversation may be as far as it goes. But no. All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind, and right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaking microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick, and usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work, but we talk about decidedly not-so-grown-up things like...
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.